it's either that or the military. You know, that always takes a hold and that keeps you pretty grounded in everything.
You were a trendsetter. Because 150 offers and you decide to go another direction, that's more like a modern phenomenon. You know, folks wait to get snatched up, leave high school and go and never look back and damn everybody else.
And I think what happened, too, I started getting the feeling my freshman year of college that I was playing baseball and basketball for other people. Mm. And that tennis was something I discovered more for myself. And I always tell parents now, no matter how talented and skilled your children are in other sports, teach them tennis, golf, swimming, so that they have lifetime sports. Because the other thing is, we run out of time with athletics. We're talking about me playing for the Pittsburgh Courier team back in the 70s with Kirk Bruce, Carl Morris, Cleve Edwards. And at age 30, I decided I can see my skills starting to decline a little bit. But in tennis, I was still getting better because I'd started later, and the pure athleticism wasn't required like it was in some of the team sports. So it all worked out for the better.
So on the tennis thing, you've been a tennis pro, and you were pretty high in a race. You were like 7th in the country at one time?
Yeah, I made it to 6th in the country.
Mm-hmm. Wow. But you stuck with education. He likes educating people. He likes teaching. You could tell that being as best he likes to teach. You know, and it rubs off on his students.
Yeah, that's the key ingredient. Yeah. I never understood people going teaching in other professions and don't like people or don't like children. I'm like, well, why are you here?
Mm-hmm. But I had a unique calling too, because even at age 21. I knew I wanted to go through the chairs, as they say. I wanted to be a teacher, a principal. I knew I had to be an assistant superintendent, small. Then I wanted to go a little bigger, and then I wanted to go into higher ed, where I could have just jumped into higher ed, but I never thought I'd have the credibility. I wanted to go through those different steps, and I don't regret that either, because, and this is the thing with the gentleman at Pittsburgh Public Schools, that, as you said about managing the budget, I'd make the analogy of basketball and football coaches that I always like when a person's been in charge of something, even if it's a junior high or high school, because you could be a coordinator or you could be a business manager and have one little piece, but that doesn't mean you can manage that entire system. So to me, experience, especially now that I'm getting older, experience is important. And you might not be the best teacher, but it's a good one.
Now, you were able to write a book on your tennis experience?
Yes, I wrote a book called The Tennis Lesson Journal, 365 Tips to Make You a Better Player. And I hoped, I had the vision that would also translate into 365 Tips to Make You a Better Accountant, a better PR professional, better parent. So we're still waiting for that to happen. But my motivation was that many times, like all things in life, people take a one-hour tennis lesson, put the racket in the back of a car somewhere in their house, don't come back for another week. This way, with that book, which is the size of an old-fashioned telephone book, you have that on your nightstand for insomnia, or you have it on your car seat. That way, you have a piece of me during a week. So people laugh because they say, well, anybody can write a book with one paragraph a day. And I said, well, it took me 2.5 years to organize those paragraphs because, again, it's like learning anything. It's the active involvement of the learner. Mm-hmm. It's not me talking down to them. So that was my contribution to writing tennis books. But I'm also working on one, the mental and emotional side of tennis, whenever I find some free time. People say, well, when are you going to retire? And, Kevin, I think you know the answer to that. Never.
Proverbial free time.
So we have in the studio, you have your first tennis student?
Yeah, I have Ken Jacob here today, who was a student of mine at age 14. Mm-hmm. I can still see him riding his bicycle to the courts. And then life got in the way. He went away to college and played tennis, got involved in other things, helping to build Three Rivers Stadium, PNC Park, Heinz Field. And then he walked back in the court. We were teaching in East Liberty at the time over at National Indoor Tennis, later called Pittsburgh Indoor Tennis. I saw this guy walk in. He looked a little bit different. He had a beard now. But I knew it was him by the walk. And sure enough, he came back. And the lesson I learned, the life lesson that I always tell people is that you never burn your bridges. People may disappear from your life momentarily, but they come back. And I always say, my students always come back. I'm always there to haunt them. So Ken now is one of my top students 30 years later.
Cool. Now, why are we talking about tennis? Why is all this tennis talk going on? Well, you know, we got Wimbledon coming up very soon at the end of the month. Always a big weekend. Everybody wants to watch Venus for various reasons. And her sister and all the other great tennis players.
Purely for the sport.
Purely for the sport, yes. You like those tennis dresses.
They don't look good on me.
Anyhow, you know, a lot of our top tennis players around the world, but a lot of people don't know about a lot of African-American tennis players. You might know maybe a handful. You might know about Venus or Serena. You know, some of the younger people don't know about Althea Gibson or Arthur Ashe or some of the other folks. I found a list of tennis players from A to Z. Only reason why people know about Steve Campbell is because he got harassed by the police. You know, I mean, he's been out there for many years.
Great promotional technique.
Yeah, but you know, until then, nobody really knew who he was. You know, and a lot of people don't pay attention to him, but they should be paying attention to him. I came up with a list of five top female African-American tennis players. Now, they might not be at the top anymore because this article is a couple years old. You know, that goes to show you how much they keep up with that by talking about it, by talking about the people that are involved. And then today I got my ESPN magazine, you know, with Muhammad Ali on the cover. It's about five or six different stories in here about Ali. And then I seen a preview about Wimbledon from a fan's view. So they have some of the top men in the world, you know. And then some of the top women. They're mentioning people like Stan Wawrinka. Did I get that right?
Yes.
And they mentioned Bjorn Borg. Bjorn. Bjorn Borg. They mentioned him.
Mm-hmm.
They mentioned Milos Raonic. And a few other things. Who? Rafael Nadal. And a few other guys. Then they mentioned Serena, Angelique Kerber, Petra Kvitova.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the woman that just got slapped on the wrist? No, that wasn't her?
That's Sharapova.
Oh, that's Sharapova. Mm-hmm. Okay. And a few other people. And Venus. Venus and Serena. But I did come up with a list of some of the top five female African-American tennis players. One was Taylor Townsend.
Mm-hmm.
Another one was Madison Keys.
Mm-hmm.
Other one was Sloane Stephens.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have Venus and Serena. So those are the top five, and that was only from a couple of years ago. Yeah, but they're always around. They're always playing. You got to really pay attention to like these different opens and different things going on. You like check out these different players. You know, I've seen some like amazing tennis players just watching the matches casually, not just like Wimbledon or the U.S. Open, but just like watching. I'm like, wow. I said, this kid's only like 15 years old, like slamming that ball, you know, hitting that ball.
And you mentioned Taylor Townsend, Kevin. Mm-hmm. Last summer, Ken and I and a couple other of my students went to Cincinnati,
mm-hmm.
which is a precursor to the U.S. Open every year. And we watched Taylor Townsend from the first row. She can hit that ball a ton, as we say.
Mm-hmm.
And a tremendous doubles player, which is unique. Because many times young players haven't had their skills steeped for doubles. They try to play singles on a doubles court. But she's a very effective doubles player, too. So she's a unique player.
So when we look at the different tennis players, what's so unique about some of these different cliques that we've been mentioning? And you could mention some of the ones that we haven't even talked about.
Well, Serena Williams is without question the best female of all time, even though some other people have more titles at this point. I think she'll catch them. But you have Margaret Court, Billie Jean King, Martina Navratilova, but Serena brings power, grace, defensive play, neutral play, the entire package, plus is strong emotionally. Venus also outstanding, but not quite the court coverage, not quite the all-court game that Serena has. But for me, Serena is in a class by herself, and we're lucky right now, to my way of thinking, because we also have the best male of all time, in my opinion, is Novak Djokovic. The biggest, the strongest, the most agile, outstanding serve, unbelievably strong mentally, which that's another factor. You get a lot of young players who look really good, and you couldn't distinguish them from Federer or Venus when they're hitting a ball. But how much do they want to win? You know, does a little bit of them die every time they lose? And that's what you have with Serena and Djokovic. Just so strong mentally and emotionally.
Now, looking at some of the players like in the 70s and the 80s, they were more like really into the real attitude-driven players, you know? Except for Billie Jean, she was just going to beat you.
But you're right. That was a golden era of tennis. And that's when I really got involved in the game of tennis, when it went from country clubs to the public courts. That's when we had the Pittsburgh Triangles here in town. In fact, my doubles partner, who coached me at one time, and then later I coached her, Peggy Michael, played on that world championship team here in Pittsburgh, the Pittsburgh Tries, in the mid-70s. And of course, they had Ken Rosewall, Vitas Karaitis. They had some very interesting characters.
All those people on Pittsburgh's team.
They were on Pittsburgh's team. You can see why they won the world championship. And Yvonne Golunov, who, by the way, was the first person of color to win a Grand Slam since Althea Gibson, which made her. You remember, she was an Aborigines. Yvonne Golunov, tremendous player. But you're right about the 70s. In fact, Kevin, I'm always asked, what's your top 10 list of all time? And you'll see that I have some 70s players in here. I have, of course, you have to have Djokovic, Federer. I have Borg, third all time. Rod Laver, there's an article in your ESPN magazine about him. What made him unique? He has modern strokes. If you had seen a clip of Laver, you couldn't tell him from today's player, whereas the other players look a little old-fashioned. Looks like Otto Graham throwing a football compared to what you would see with Roethlisberger. Then I have Arthur Ashe, fifth, another player of the 70s. Great player, great ambassador, by the way, for civil rights, for human relations. He did it in a very calm, unobtrusive, nuanced way compared to Muhammad Ali, but they were on the same page, but different personality. They did it in a different way.
But Althea Gibson and Arthur Ashe made a transition from Jim Crow into, like, modern civil rights.
Exactly right. And here's something a lot of people don't know about Althea Gibson. She was born in South Carolina. Her family moved to Harlem, and neighbors actually took up a collection to finance lessons for her at the Cosmopolitan Tennis Club in Sugar Hill. And she was fortunate to meet Dr. Walter Johnson, who later mentored Arthur Ashe. But here's the piece that a lot of people don't know. This woman was so athletic that she retired from tennis in 58 and was on the golf tour in 1960. So imagine that. Of course, I always tease my golf friends and pros and say, we can go, they're going to kill me for this, but I'll say it anyway, we can go from tennis to golf, but I'm not sure that all the golfers can go from golf to tennis, because they say, how can you say that? I always say, well, tennis is a combination of basketball and golf. You need the precision and the quiet mind of golf, but you need the athleticism of basketball to cover that court. So yeah, Althea Gibson was definitely the pace setter, great champion. And, of course, Arthur Ashe has always been one of my favorites. Great backhand. Great human being, singles and doubles player. And went to UCLA and on scholarship and actually worked with Pancho Gonzalez, who's another one of the all-time greats. I have him on my top 10 list of all time. I'm old enough to remember Pancho. He was a wild man, but he was a tremendous coach. He also coached Agassi for a while.
Now, Pancho Gonzalez was in the 60s.
Yeah, he was late 50s, mm-hmm. early 60s.
We haven't mentioned the one guy. I hate to say I channel every once in a while, and I'll tell people I'm having a McEnroe moment.
You cannot be serious. You cannot be serious. He at least was entertaining. I don't know how good he was, but he was at least entertaining.
Yeah, McEnroe was a character. The thing about him we always talk about is how great his hands were. And McEnroe was a very good high school basketball player. So he brought a lot more athleticism to a tennis court than many of his contemporaries. Now you see more athletic players. Back when I started playing, the average height of a man on the pro tour was 5'10", and a woman 5'6". Now the men are probably 6'3",
yeah.
and the women are 5'11". So you can just see the difference in the evolution of athleticism into the game, too. And part of that was the fact that it did go from a country club setting to the public setting. So the sport has really benefited from that.
On my alphabetical list, I'm looking at, well, we're looking at, in the B's, we're looking at a Camille Benjamin, Tornado, Alicia Black,
mm-hmm.
James Blake,
mm-hmm.
Thomas Blake. Now, are they brothers?
Yes.
Okay. And Rene Blanc.
James Blake, probably one of the best forehands of all time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, James was a unique guy. He wanted to do it his way. I know some of the Davis Cup captains, the McEnroes, would get really frustrated, but, you know, James was kind of like Bill Tilden way back from the 30s. He said, I'm going to play my own sweet game. Let me hit that hard, flat forehand, because that's who he was. And I've learned that now. Teaching tennis 40 years now, I learned that all my students look different. They don't all look the same. You can't put a cookie cutter just like you can't with a university student. A lot of it is pulling out what they naturally have.
Mm-hmm.
But James Blake was going to hit that hard, flat forehand regardless. But he also had a lot of physical problems growing up. Had to wear a back brace. The only time he took that brace off is when he was playing tennis. But interesting guy. Very intelligent guy. And his brother, very good too, but didn't achieve quite to the level that James did.
Now, Zena Garrison is another great player, but she kind of like faded out of the limelight.
Well, you know what's interesting about Zena, too, from Houston, and she was good friends and contemporaries with Lori McNeil, and a lot of people don't know that. Charlie McNeil's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, Charlie played for the San Diego Chargers.
Okay.
Was a wide receiver, but those two were very good players. In fact, Lori McNeil won a French Open doubles in 88 and 33 career titles, which is really significant. That's not 33 Grand Slams, but 33 career titles. Zena Garrison had a long career. I'll tell you a funny story about Zena Garrison. You guys will all love this. I was teaching Franco Harris over at the old Green Tree Racquet Club about 20 years ago. And I was teaching Franco and his son, Doc, and his wife. So Franco said, Bucky, I'm going to start taking a lesson every day for a month because I'm going to play a doubles match against Zena Garrison and somebody else on the tour. And I started laughing, just like you guys did. And Franco, with his pride, said, what is so funny? I said, Franco, you think I'm going to be able to get you ready in 1 month? Now, if you give me 5 years, he didn't believe me. And I said, well, who's your partner? And I was hoping he would say, like, Jimmy Connors or Arthur Ashe. And he said, well, I'm going to be playing with Johnny Johnson from the Arizona Cardinals. I said, you guys have no chance, but you're going to have a good time. And I don't think Franco ever forgave me for that. But we had fun with that, and of course his game really improved. You talk about a big serve and a forehand. Franco had that.
Talk about athletes that played in two sports. We got John Lucas.
Mm-hmm.
John Lucas, second. Yeah.
Another tremendous tennis player. I think if John Lucas would have focused on tennis, 6'3", mm-hmm. left-handed, played world team tennis, of course, I think he would have had an unprecedented career. He could have been a top 10 player in the world. But, of course, his main sport was basketball. And tennis is a jealous mistress. If you're playing basketball, pro basketball, and pro tennis at the same time, you just can't do it. That's why I had to pack it in with tennis in the with basketball in the 70s. There just weren't enough hours in the day to compete with the guys and girls who are playing 6-7 hours a day.
Right. Yeah. Another person we are in the Keys, we got Madison Keys and Raquel Atwell.
Madison Keys, tremendous player. 5'10", semifinalist at Australia, out of Florida. Very athletic, good serve, hits the ball with a lot of pace. That we saw her play 2 years ago in Cincinnati, and we're really impressed. She just ran into Sharapova when Sharapova was really having a good day. Most people thought Madison Keys would beat her. Hits the ball really hard.
Now, we have a lot of folks coming up now in the thing with Wimbledon. A lot of controversy this year with the drug testing and them finding different substances that athletes have been taking for years, and they finally, like, say, well, you can't do that. We're going to have to suspend you, even though you told us, and this, that, and the other. So what's your take on this latest thing with the drug testing and things like that going on?
Well, the one thing, Kevin, and guys, that I find very interesting is it seems to depend on the sport, mm-hmm. how the people in the public perceive it.
Uh-huh.
That when people insinuate that the Steelers and the Chargers were using steroids during the 70s, people just say, well, that's the culture of football. Many people say that.
Mm-hmm.
Baseball, of course, who will ever forgive Mark McGwire and some of the other players? But, you know, we need a level playing field. I'm more moderate on it than Roger Federer, who says that, hey, lifetime ban if you're ever caught using anything. He has a zero tolerance look at it. But I think they need to look at that with Sharapova, because she's been prescribed this drug since 2006. And it's actually a heart drug called melodronium. And the downside is it does promote recovery and endurance and blood flow. So I think that's what the World Anti-Doping Society is looking at. But generally, it sits on three criteria. Is it performance enhancing? Is it detrimental to the person's health? Or is it against the spirit of sport? That's kind of legalese. Is it against the spirit of sport? And they're hanging their head on number three. But a lot of us think that on appeal, she might win that, given the fact that she was taking that since 2006. And they didn't ban it until January of this year.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a feeling that it won't be overturned quickly enough for her to play Wimbledon. But I have a feeling we might see her by the U.S. Open.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's always going to be a problem. You know, it's science and all. They're always coming up with all kind of drugs to do everything from better eyesight to better sleeping to, you know, digesting your food better to weight loss to weight gain. I mean, it's something for everything. And they don't always know, even though they do some level of testing, thank God. They don't know what the effects are going to be. They're making synthetic drugs and all. I wonder. The Steeler example is interesting because you really sit back and look at what those folk put themselves through. It's like, well, hell, how do you think they play that long? If they have a long career. I mean, seriously, once they got a certain size, that's why these guys are getting hurt now. They're so huge. I know, I always tell people, I would be the best receiver ever. I would be the fastest. And they look at me like I'm crazy. And I'd say, you know why? Because I'd be scared. Nobody that big would ever hit me. I would run so fast. You know, because I could only get one game, one play. And once they hit me, I'd have to, you know, go to the locker room in the stretcher or whatever. But, I mean, when you think about it, folks is in excess of 300 pounds, and they can run. Back when I was young, that was my whole card. If I couldn't fight you, I always knew I could outrun you. And starting when in the 60s in high school, Ellison and them came along. Hey, great big. They can run as fast as me. And I was like, that's not fair. That is not fair at all.
And I also think sometimes we're not tolerant enough for the athlete. Like, you'll hear people say, well, every athlete knows what goes in his or her body. But when you have a trusted doctor, pharmacist, trainer saying to you, take this pill or tablet.
That'll take away the inflammation you have. Right?
It's very easy to take it. And after all, you're not a pharmacist. You don't have a list of the banned drugs. So I, for one, am a lot more tolerant of that, especially when I look at the gestalt of all the sports.
And if you take any medicine over a length of time, they will give you 5, 6, 7, 8 different medicines with names you can't pronounce, and they'll tell you they're all doing the same thing. So go figure. If you're not some kind of chemist or somebody, you know.
Now, looking at the ranks of all the African-American tennis players right now, who do you see rising to the top? Who do you see, taking over, like in Wimbledon or the U.S. Open or some of these other big tournaments coming up?
Well, one player who is currently flying below the radar, who we think is going to be an up-and-coming star, is Francis Tiafoe. He's only 18 years old, out of Maryland, College Park, Maryland. And ironically, he had a Russian coach who I worked with at Green Tree 15 years ago named Misha Konetsikov, who coached him for 10 years. Although Misha's not real happy right now because the USTA saw how good Tiafoe is and assigned him Jose Higueras. And that's after Misha had given up his job to coach a player. But we have high hopes for Francis Tiafoe, who's 171 in the country at age 18, which is really outstanding for a guy, because typically the women peak a little sooner in terms of maturity. The other player we've always waited to come around is Donald Young from Georgia. He's 75th in the country. We always said he was going to be the next great American player, and we still think at age 26 he has time to put it all together, get a little bit steadier on the court. We also have the Pittsburgh area named Bjorn Frantantamo, who we hope gets in the world. He trains at Alpha Tennessee Fitness when he's in town. So we're excited about him. But we've always been bemoaning the lack of American tennis players, Jimmy Connors and John McEnroe.
You can't be serious.
I couldn't resist. So right now we're at John Isner, number 17 in the world. So we're really hoping that Francis Tiafoe can scale that top 10. We think he will within the next 3 years.
Players being developed, are they coming out of high school? Or are they coming out of the colleges? I mean, where exactly are these talents coming from?
Well, one thing that's happening now is we are identifying players with a lot of natural talent at a younger age, which you didn't have 20 years ago. So we have a much better population of outstanding athletes being trained earlier and having access to lessons. Some play college tennis. Others, like Frantangelo, pass on college tennis. I personally like to see them get the education, because especially if they're playing D1 tennis, they can still play at a very high level and then get the emotional and mental maturity. But we are doing a much better job at developing, and this is exactly why this Francis Tiafoe is pretty much scooped up by the USTA, given Jose Higueras to coach him, because we're just not doing a good job vis-a-vis the other countries in the world. Women, it's not as noticeable because we do have Serena, and we have Venus, and we have Madison Keys, you mentioned, who's ranked 16th in the world, and you mentioned Sloane Stephens. So we do have 4 American women in the top 20. Although I think Serena, I always take Serena against the field. I mean, she's going to win Wimbledon unless she's injured. But I also feel the same way about Djokovic.
So Serena Wimbledon and Djokovic in the men?
Barring injury, you always take those two.
Okay. Well, that's a, you know, perspective on how many people play. Like I said before, I don't know how long. I think it's
Jamie's power is great. I mean, she's just marvelous to watch, you know. And her skills, competitive nature, she's like, okay, I'm playing around. Now that she's injured or something, I mean, she's anywhere near her game, she just blew you out the court.
Well, you know, tennis has definitely taken over the hearts and minds of America, especially when it comes to the beginning of June and the beginning of July, because everybody is tuned to Wimbledon. You know, check it out those matches.
And as teaching pros, I have to say we like it because as people are fixed on the television set, many of them get inspired and motivated to take lessons in group clinics. So we're always excited during Wimbledon, and especially the U.S. Open. It's amazing how many people take up tennis or decide that their children will be the next superstars and discover the great game of tennis.
So if someone's interested in, like, getting their kid involved in tennis and things like that, and they want to say, well, I want to get a tennis pro to teach them, how could they get, like, in contact?
They can look at my website, which is drbyronphillips.com or buckytennis.com, B-U-C-K-Y, tennis.com. Or call me at 412-736-1070. And we teach people from age 4 to age 84. So I like the fact that I have a diverse group of students. A lot of times as a young pro, you fantasize about it, having the next Serena Williams or Venus Williams. But as Misha found out, many times when you start somebody, you don't own them. You just lease them. At some point, they're moving on to somebody else. So you can't put all your eggs into one basket. But I learned that at a young age that I respect every student. The 84-year-old is just as important as the D1 player. And
every time he says that, he looks at me.
I'm not here. I'm only in my 60s. I'm not
here. What country produces the best players?
And will it stand even?
Like right now, tennis is going, you know, global. So I think every country is getting the good tennis players. The Djokovic is in Serbia. Mm-hmm. Australia has been strong in tennis for many years.
Spain, Russia, of course.
Where are most people training at? Are they training here?
We still get a lot of people who train with my buddy Nick Bollettieri in Bradenton, Florida. And, of course, one of my mentors, the late, great Vic Braden. We had a lot of people train with him in California and then later Utah. But he passed away last year. We miss him. But you get a lot of people training in Paris and training in Spain as well.
I mean, there are a lot of South American players now. A couple of the Canadians, Eugene Bouchard and Louis Rovich, are a couple of rising stars. We have from Great Britain, Ian Murray.
So it's spread around pretty good.
You know, I wanted to talk about tennis, but I didn't want to, like, leave this program without even talking about, we talked about Muhammad Ali briefly last week with Mark Anthony Neal and yourself, and I kind of tuned in and chimed in on that, and he was relating Ali's quiet revolution, but not so quiet revolution, you know, and how that inspired, like, a lot of young black males to, like, do what they do, like you and I, you know. Not only did that fuel our revolutionary spirit or our spirit to resist, but among a whole bunch of other people during that time period, like, inspired, like, a whole nation of young people to, like, really...
Until he came along, it never crossed my mind to box. And, you know, all we did was put some gloves on, go in Saxon Alley, and I found out how long 3 minutes was. I was like, y'all cheating. You hit the nail.
It's a long
time. You're winning, it's not long, but if you're losing. But his skill in the game he played, the Saturday night fights was two big guys trading punches. Boom, boom. And it was, like, brutal. And I looked at that and said, well, I can never do that. But then when I saw that you could fight and not get hit, like, ooh, that's revolutionary. And for a heavyweight, it was really revolutionary because I had never seen him move around like that. So I'm just glad and feel privileged to have been living and youthful and just right along, you know, with him, so to speak. He was like a big brother or something.
Yeah, my granddaughters were out there They were asking me about Ali. And I said, yeah, I watched Muhammad Ali box. Oh, I said, I watched about all of his matches. Then I said, we can go back and look at some of the YouTube stuff. And then yesterday, we were watching Jesse Owens' movie. Did you see Race?
No.
Really yeah, good, good yeah. Really good movie. You know, as far as like truly depicting what Jesse Owens went through from you know, growing up in New York and going to Ohio State and the whole thing in Germany and
see, I don't
the head of the head of the AAU, that which is very interesting thing in the deal he tried to strike with the Germans and stuff. That was like.
See, I don't like to watch a lot of this because I have super macaroon moments.
Boy, my jaws get tight. I'm like, ugh.
Yeah, that's just like the recent revamping of Roots. You know,
I have it on tape. I haven't looked at
which
it.
Which is really,
it'll
really
be interesting when
people are upset. But you know, I watched the first one, you know, and then the grandkids, they're sitting with me watching the second one, and I'm telling them about this stuff. I'm telling them about. Their great, 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 great grandparents, you know, who were actually born into slavery and what they actually went through. I'm like, look, this stuff was not, 100 years is not that far away. 200 years, that's like nothing compared to the rest of the world. You know,
Zappa always used this as a young person into my teen years and possibly into my 20s. I breathed air with people who have been slaves.
Yeah. So how long ago could that have been?
Yeah.
You know, people aren't living like Methuselah. They're not 900 years old.
But like, getting back to the Ali thing, there are a whole lot of articles that are out there. It's, all you got to do is like look them up. Some brilliant pieces that folks have been writing because they actually sit down and like thought about how great this man really was. You know, and
not just boxes, so many different ways they're coming at it, from his poetry to his oratory to his cultural meaning, his pop status. I mean, there's so many ways that folks are looking at who he was.
Posted the rabbi who spoke at his service. Mm-hmm. Go listen to his speech. He said, we need to strive to be Ali. He said, he just left it like that, plain and simple. And then he was talking about his coming up as a rabbi. You know, he was obviously from the 60s, because you can tell by his rhetoric, by like, hey, it was rough out there, but he did it. We went through all, you know, and,
I told my little piece I felt inspired to be. I was watching the night, and it was late in Bowdoin College. And we're about to miss dinner, but it had none of time. Oscar Bonavito. 70-something. Damn, we came out of the room about 4 minutes. He was on the
shoulders
crying.
Ali, Ali, Ali.
We came into the cafeteria, but I was looking. But, I mean, he was definitely a phenomenon.
Yeah.
Well, and, you know, back to Ali, two things from a professor coach's point of view is he had that style with the hands down, which many people criticize. But the way I adapted that as a teacher and a pro is something I alluded to earlier. People have their own style. He wouldn't have been as good with his hands on there. That's who he was, and he was able to pull that off. So you teach people inside out, not outside in.
Yeah.
The other thing is how he reinvented himself. As a little kid, I remember watching Warren Spahn pitch. I don't know if you guys remember him, but he was old even when we were young.
Milwaukee Braves.
Yes. Warren Spahn went from being a fireballer to being a slow baller. He learned how to win without pitches. And Ali with that rope-a-dope, pure genius, where when he lost just a little bit, he was willing to take those punches and become a defensive counter-puncher. I just thought that was the coolest thing going, because we all need to reinvent ourselves.
Absolutely. Yeah. When they showed that clip, I just saw it recently where the guy's throwing them punches and he's just that misses like 20 times. Like, that's outstanding.
Wow. Well,
kids don't do that at home.
We're up against it. I mean, I had a great time talking to you, Dr. Phillips.
Yes.
I hope you invite me back again sometime. I'd love to join you guys again on any topic.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Definitely come back. Thank you for coming in.
Yep.
Thank you for listening, folks. Thank you, Rick.
Right.
Back again.
What I like to say, you can't be right, then be left.
Dan's up next. WRCT Pittsburgh. Thank you.
up here. WRCT Pittsburgh.
It's on, honey. It's okay.
And several other charges. Searchers have recovered the body of a 2-year-old Nebraska boy snatched by an alligator at Walt Disney World. The boy was attacked last night as he waded in shallow water at the edge of the Seven Seas Lagoon at Disney's Grand Floridian Resort. The boy has been identified as Lane Graves of Elkhorn, Nebraska. The FBI is asking for more assistance in...